I'll ask you to turn, please, to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. We've been singing about God's grace and saving us. And then after we are born again, his strengthening grace that we are dependent on every day. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. I don't know how many teachers still do it, but one of the most feared aspects of school was what we called the pop quiz. The pop quiz. You'd come in thinking that you had no quizzes or tests in a particular class, and then the teacher would pull a fast one on you and ask you to take out a piece of paper. And if you hadn't done your homework, if you hadn't read your assigned reading well, you knew you were in big trouble. Pop quizzes can strike fear even into the most astute students. What do pop quizzes do? Perhaps some teachers had sinister motives for them, but I think most of them probably wanted to use the pop quiz to see, one, whether you did your homework, and two, whether you actually comprehended what you were reading, if you learned anything. And Paul is going to give the Corinthians a pop quiz. You would think it'd be an easy pop quiz because it's only three questions, a three-question pop quiz. And the reason he's giving them this pop quiz is to see if they've learned anything. And as they realize, most of them have not, to help them to come to the right conclusion. Because pop quizzes can actually help you to learn. You can learn things through quizzes and tests when you miss the answer and then find out what the correct answer is. But before Paul gives them a pop quiz, that'll come in verse 7. He starts in verse 6 with reminding them of their problem. Reminding them of their problem. And the problem, quite simply stated, was that many in this church were inflated with pride. Inflated with pride. Look at verse 6. He says, "Now these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, so that in us you may learn not to exceed what is written, so that no one of you will become arrogant in behalf of one against the other. For who regards you as superior? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it? You already are filled. You already have become rich. You have become kings without us. Indeed, I wish that you had become king so that we might also reign with you." The problem is that these believers, not all of them, but perhaps the majority, were inflated with pride. And he says, what has this whole section been about planting and watering and laying a foundation and building on that foundation? What has this all been about? He said, it's not been about becoming a better farmer, knowing when to plant your crops and how to water it and weed it and what fertilizers you should use. It's not about going to school to become an architect, to become a better construction worker. He says, I have written these things to figuratively apply them to myself and Apollos for your sake, so that you might learn something. The word here that's translated figuratively applied has the idea of changing the appearance of a disguise. So here it has the idea of changing something literal into a figure of speech, transforming the ideas of a builder and a planter and an architect and a farmer, and then applying that to a spiritual purpose, employing them as metaphors, we would say, to illustrate Paul's role and to illustrate Apollos' role in the Corinthian church. Because Paul was not a literal farmer. He was not a literal architect. He was a tent maker and a preacher. So why use these metaphors? He says, verse 6, he says, I've done it for your sakes. It wasn't to show what a great writer he was, how he could turn phrases. He was saying, I did it for your sakes, for the benefit of this church, to help you to see that Apollos and I, we are simply servants. That's all we are. We're just farmers of the king. He owns the field. We work for him. We're just builders for God. He owns the building. We are simply his workers. And he says, I've done it so that you may learn, verse 6, not to exceed what is written. In other words, I think what he's saying is, I want you to learn not to go beyond what the Bible teaches. And when you become inflated with pride, when you set yourself up as a follower of this man or of this man, and you have divisions in the church and disunity, when you are inflated with pride, he says, you have gone beyond what the Bible teaches. He says, learn not to go beyond what the Bible teaches. In Paul's case, he was saying, don't make Apollos and Peter and myself into heroes. We're not heroes. We're just servants. That's all that we are. Paul is saying that your wisdom here in the Corinthian church, your wisdom which mirrors the world's wisdom, your wisdom has gone beyond what the Bible teaches, and it actually contradicts the gospel. And what is the gospel? The gospel teaches that Jesus, the greatest, became the lowest so that we might be saved. What were the Corinthians doing? They wanted to bypass that part about becoming low because they thought they were already great. He says, your wisdom is actually contradicting what the Bible teaches, God's wisdom, so you have gone beyond what is written in the Word of God. And instead of becoming servants, you have become inflated in your selfish pride. Notice the end of verse 6. It says, I want you to learn this so that none of you will become arrogant in behalf of one against the other. I think Paul is saying he knows this has already happened in the church at Corinth. It's not just a possibility, it was a reality. You say, this should be self-evident. I mean, all of us know that pride is wrong. Well, in Greek culture, for instance, from the writings of Plato, how did they view humility? Humility was not considered a virtue to be emulated. Humility was considered a sign of a weak person. And you did not want to be humble because you wanted to be strong. Great men were not to be humble. And Paul says, that's wrong. This word for arrogant here literally means puffed up, inflated. So we might say, in common English idiom, we might say something like, this guy's a windbag. Okay? He's saying a lot, but he's not saying anything because he's proud. Or we might say, there's a lot of hot air, right? I hope there's not a lot of hot air in here right now because I'm the only one talking. But you might say, somebody has a lot of hot air. They're like a balloon. They're inflated and it's just about to pop. And when it pops, it's going to be a catastrophe. He says, you are puffed up. Maybe he's saying, notice verse 6 where he says, in behalf of one against the other. Maybe he's saying, you have taken sides. Some of you are siding with me, Paul. Some of you are siding with Apollos. That's certainly possible, but I don't think that's what the focus is because of the shift that takes place in verse 7. I think what Paul is saying, one against the other, he means one Christian versus the other Christian in the church. They were taking sides, but as they were taking sides, now they were actually not just aligning themselves with their favorite Bible teacher and theologian, they were now setting themselves at odds with their brothers and sisters in the church. And they had become inflated with pride, meaning they knew they were right. And they wouldn't be told otherwise. They were filled with hot air. They were inflated with pride. So that's the problem in verse 6. But in verse 7, Paul gets to the pop quiz. I want to see how you would do on this pop quiz, just from memory. It is an open book quiz, I guess, so that's beneficial. But how would you do on this pop quiz? It's only three questions. Three questions, and it's really easy to remember because he uses three diagnostic questions. First question is who, the second question is what, the third question is why? Who, what, why? First question on this pop quiz, question number one, who? He says in verse 7, who regards you as superior? This word superior has the basic idea of making a distinction between, distinguishing between two people, and thus the idea of looking at two people and saying, he's better, he's worse, or I'm better, she's worse. Who makes you different? Who makes you superior? So Paul is saying, just for the sake of argument, let's pretend here that you are superior to some other people in your church, and that's debatable. But he says, for sake of argument, let's say you are superior, you are better than somebody else in your church. Well, who made you that way? Who made you that way? If you are better, if you have better good looks, if you have more talent, if you have a better brain, if you're stronger, faster, smarter, more successful, who gave that to you? Who made you different? Notice he doesn't answer the question. It's a rhetorical question, but the answer is obvious. The answer is God did. The question is who? The answer is God. You say, this is an easy pop quiz. It is an easy pop quiz to understand, but it's a hard one to live out. And that's what the Corinthian believers were struggling with. Of course they knew that God made them different. Here's the blessing, friends, is that our differences are God-given. They're not to be a source of pride because God gave them to us. And if he chose to give you something that he didn't choose to give to somebody else, that doesn't make you better. That makes God awesome. It's just part of his character that he gives gifts to whom he wills as he chooses for the benefit of the body. So the first question is who, and the answer is God. How are you doing on the pop quiz so far? Let's move to the second question. The second question is what? What? Notice verse 7. What do you have that you did not receive? What do you have that wasn't given to you? In other words, what do you have that wasn't because of God's grace? Is there anything that you are that isn't because of God, that hasn't come from God? Is there anything that you have that God did not give to you? Can you come up with one thing? You'll sit here for a long time and you won't be able to come up with anything. Everything you are and everything you have is because God gave it to you. How about your life? You exist because of God. Without God's choice, you and I don't exist. Your breath. Every day that you wake up because God chose for you to wake up. Your looks, good or bad or mediocre. Why do you have them? Because of God. Your mind. Why do you have the mind that you have? Because of God. You say, I've really developed my mind. Well, good. Who gave you the strength to develop that mind? God. Your abilities. Some of you are great singers. I can't say that for myself, but who gave that to you? God did. Some of you are wonderful at playing instruments and making music. Who gave that ability to you? God did. Some of you are really fast. Why are you fast? Because God wanted you to be fast. Some of you are slow. Why are you slow? Too many Big Macs, maybe. I'm joking. God gave you a range and you can work within that range, but if you're remotely fast, you're fast because God made you fast. Some of you are good at public speaking. Why are you a good public speaker? Because God made you that way. Some of you are gifted at creating art. Why are you good at art? Why are you creative? Because God wanted you to be creative. And the list could go on and on. Some of you are good at organizing and spreadsheets. Why are you good at that? Because God gave you a mind to do that. How about your personality? Why do you have the personality that you do? Because God made you that way. Why do you have the positions that you have, be it in the church, be it at work, at your school, maybe you're elected to student body? Why do you have the positions that you have? It's not because you're so winsome or because you're so popular. It's because God made you successful. Why do you have the family that you have? Why were you born into the family that you were born in? Wasn't because you did anything before you were born to earn it. It's because God chose it for you. Or the house that you have, or the condo, or the apartment, or the basement suite, or the room that you have. It's all a gift of God's grace. How about your friends? Some of you make friends so easily. Why do you have the friends that you do? Because of God's grace. And ultimately, how about your salvation? Because God is a gracious God. Everything from start to finish, A to Z, is God's grace in your life. So what is bragging? Bragging about what we are, what we've accomplished, how gifted we are, our abilities, our talents, our winsomeness, our personality, our strength, our biceps, our brain. Bragging about what we have reveals what? Reveals a proud heart, which says, I deserve this. I deserve that. This is the epitome of pride. When we take something that God has given us and we say, I deserve it, and we just get puffed up and we become pompous windbags. But on the flip side, because as I was giving that list, some of you were thinking, nope, I don't have that. Nope, I don't have that. Nope, can't do that. Complaining about what you don't have also reveals what? A proud heart. Because you, when you complain about what you don't have or what you can't do or what God hasn't given you, you say, I deserve better. And you accuse the gracious God of not giving you what you ought to have had. So bragging and complaining both have the same root issue, which is we're inflated with pride. So the second question in this pop quiz is what? And it's starting to get a little more convicting, isn't it? The question is what? And the answer is, what's the answer? Nothing. Nothing. The first question was who, and the answer was God. The second question is what? And the answer is nothing. Everything I have is a gift of God's grace. So, hopefully you're not 0 for 2 now, maybe 1 for 2, but let's see if we can go 2 for 3 or 3 for 3. I was going to say 60% is pretty good, but it's not actually 2 out of 3. Some of you would say, yeah, I'll take that. That's passing, baby. Third question, why? Why? He says in verse 7, why do you boast as if you had not received it? If God's the one who made you different, and God's the one who gave you everything, why do you brag as if you have not received it? So the bragger is not only asserting, I deserve this, the bragger is also asserting something even more arrogant. He's not only saying, I deserve this, he's saying, I deserve it and I did it myself. I did it myself. I'm a self-made man. I did it myself. Now, probably very few of us would have the audacity to actually say this out loud, right? You know, we're talking conversation after, and you're coming back out the back door, and I'm shaking your hand, and I say, how was your week? Oh, it was terrible, Pastor Michael. Why not? Nobody recognizes how great of a person I am. We don't put it that crassly, we don't put it that bluntly, but we leave services and we're frustrated because our contributions haven't been welcome. Nobody made me feel special, or at work, nobody appreciates all I'm doing, or at home. Work, 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 that's all I do for this family and nobody cares. That's how we express these kinds of things generally. We don't usually say, God, you blew it. But we reflect it in our despair, we reflected in our ingratitude, we reflected in our complaining, all evidences of pride. The bragger and the complainer are both ignoring the fact that everything that they have comes from God. Let me say it this way. Ignoring God's goodness, ignoring God's grace is pride. That's what it is. Ignoring God's grace is pride. When we say, I deserve this, I deserve better, or I did it myself, we're ignoring the goodness of God and pretending that we have done it because we are great. I think it was Blake. If I'm wrong on this, Blake, correct me later. But I think it was Blake one time that was singing a little song as he was walking around the house, probably a 3 or 4 year old guy. And the song went something like this. I love me. I love me. I mean, that could have been the theme song of the church at Corinth. I love me. I'm so great. And I wish everybody knew it. So the third question, why? And the answer is what? What's the answer? Why do we brag as if we had not received it? What's the answer? Pride. Exactly. Pride. We're puffed up with pride when we think we deserve it and we did it ourselves. Sometimes we begin to think that we are so essential to the work of God that if somehow we were incapacitated or removed from this planet, that God's work would come to a screeching halt. There's a missionary named Ernie Presswood. Ernie Presswood. By the way, I'd encourage you to get these books that are on the back table here, Daring Devotion, Daring Dependence. Ernie Presswood, his story is in here, a little snippet of his life. Lisa and I have read through these together, and now we're reading through them with our kids on Saturday night for our family devotions. Highly recommended. But Ernie Presswood entered the world in 1908 in a little town called Deloraine, Manitoba. Have any of you ever heard of Deloraine? Really? Wow. I had never heard of it. I had to look it up. It's really close to the U.S. border, just southwest of Winnipeg. He answered God's call to go as a missionary to the country of Borneo. It's the third largest island in the world. Do you know where Borneo is? I know that some of you back in this section should, right? Because it's right below the Philippines. It's got a different name now, and I'm not sure if I could pronounce it correctly. Kalimantan. Kalimantan. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that accurately. But it's just south of Mindanao, it looks like, west of Indonesia. So the climate here, and I'm not talking about the weather, but the spiritual and social climate here was just depravity. Shortly after he got there as a missionary, Ernie said, "As far as I know, there is not one soul here who knows what it is to be saved. For many centuries, these people have been under the bondage and fear of Satan, and the fruit that he has produced greatly resembles himself." And then he lists this fruit that looks like Satan and his qualities. Ignorance, superstition, witchcraft, corruption of mind, filth, disease, suffering. In the past, they were headhunters. The Dutch government tried to keep that in check under their rule, but it was just a culture riddled with depravity. But the gospel started changing lives. People were being born again, and they gave Ernie the name Tuan Change, which means Mr. Change, because of the transformation that they were seeing in lives. God was changing lives. You think, this is great. And it was great, but there was a problem in the missionary's heart that God had to remedy through some chastening. Ernie developed an ulcer in his foot, which made him leave Borneo for 7 months to go east to one of the islands of Indonesia called Sulawesi. And so 7 months he was there laid up, unable to work among the people that he wanted to work among. And yet, you know what happened? The gospel kept going forward and the church kept advancing without him. And Presswood admitted, quote, "I was beginning to look upon myself as somewhat indispensable." You know what indispensable means, kids? You got to have it. It's essential. So if you get a Big Mac meal, since we're on the theme of Big Macs this morning, you get a combo, you've got to have then fries and a drink. I'm not recommending it. I'm just saying this is reality. The fries are indispensable to a Big Mac combo. Indispensable means you have to be there. You are essential. I was beginning to look upon myself as somewhat indispensable, so the Lord had to teach me I was not. And how did the Lord do that? By removing him from the mission field for a time, and the work continued to go forward. Well, he was able to return to Borneo and continue the work. And he was there for a year. And then the Japanese captured him, because this was in the 1940s, World War II going on. The Japanese captured him and put him in a prison camp for 3 years with a man named Russell Diebler, which you might know. They were in prison camp together and they spread the gospel. They tended to patients. And amazingly, they survived this 3 years in a Japanese prison camp. He was released, but his health was so weakened that after he returned to Borneo, he had a fever. His body was so weakened that it gave out, and he died at the age of 38. Indispensable, essential, completely necessary. Can happen to any of us. Have you begun to view yourself as indispensable to the work of God? The Corinthians had. So Paul challenges them in verse 8. He says, "You are already filled. You are already filled. You have already become rich." I think here Paul is being facetious. Do you know what it means to be facetious, kids? It's kind of like sarcasm, but a nicer form of sarcasm, where you're saying something, but you're kind of joking a little bit here. You're teasing them. You're saying, you think that you are already filled. You have eaten enough, meaning you don't need me spiritually anymore. You're way beyond me. You left me behind a long time ago. You are so filled up spiritually. You have arrived spiritually. That's what a lot of these Corinthian believers were saying. They're saying, we're mature. We've arrived. We've made it. We don't need Paul anymore. We have arrived. When I think of an illustration of this, I think of the old show Andy Griffith. I think of Barney Fife. The overconfident deputy, always rushing into a situation thinking, yeah, I've got it. And he'll say, you sure, Barney? Yeah, I've got it. And then very quickly he gets humble. That's the way these Corinthian believers were. Yeah, we've got it. We're okay. And they're about to get humbled. You've already arrived. You have the self-assurance. He says, you have already become rich. What do you need me for? You've got everything that you need. He says, you have become kings without us. You are reigning like kings without us, without our help. You don't need us, Paul says. He's being facetious. He's saying, you guys think you're practically royalty. You're special. You don't even need our help. You're self-sufficient. You're living like a king. How do kings generally live? Well, looking for prestige, power, and people to follow them. And that's essentially what the Corinthians were saying. We're kings. We've got prestige. We've got power. And we've got people to follow us. We've arrived. Notice what Paul says. He says, indeed, verse 8, I wish that you had become kings so that we might also reign with you. Paul pops their pride here. He bursts their balloon. He says, I wish it were true that you really were kings spiritually, but you're not. You're peasants spiritually. He's saying, if you are self-reliant, you can be sure that you are self-deceived. If you are self-assured as a Christian, you can be sure that you are self-deceived. Paul says, if you were kings, our ministry would not have been as challenging as it was. It would have been a lot easier. And he's going to detail some of the differences between the Corinthians' view of life and the way Paul and Apollos and the other apostles actually experienced it. Paul is reminding them that exaltation only comes after humiliation, as one writer puts it. Exaltation in the Christian life only comes after humiliation. The Corinthians, they wanted the exaltation, but they did not want the humiliation that was required, the humility that was required for God to lift them up. What Paul is reminding them and what he's reminding us today is that an awareness of God's grace should result in gratitude. An awareness of God's grace in our lives should result in gratitude. If you can look at everything that God has given you, if you can look at everything that you are and that you become, the talents, abilities, positions, your house, your car, if you can look at all of that and it doesn't result in gratitude, then you have missed the point and you have forgotten where it came from. Everything in our lives, good or bad, is a result of God's grace. The chastening that He uses when we made bad choices, it's all of God's grace. Illustrate it this way. Most of you probably know that our dear Isabel, Don's wife, was hit by a truck about 9 weeks ago, and we thought she was going to die, but God has spared her and has restored a lot of function to her beyond what we anticipated. But one of the things after the accident that was missing were her upper teeth, her dentures. They were gone. They were gone. Nowhere to be found. Don had assumed that they had gotten knocked out and were there on 16th and had been long run over by now. They were gone. Well, Don called me the other day and said, the dentures, they're back. He didn't use those words, but that was the idea. They just showed up in the hospital again. They brought them to us, and I asked the nurse where they had come from, and she didn't quite know. So we don't know what happened, if they got lost when she was taken to the ICU, but they're back, and it helps a lot. It's going to help her with chewing and all of those sorts of things. It's going to save them some money. Just a gift of God's grace that these dentures appeared out of the blue. So an awareness that this gift was of God's grace resulted in what? Gratitude from Don, and he was expressing his gratitude to the Lord yesterday. While we're talking about teeth, you may have noticed that I am not as filled with teeth as I once was, and I don't have a dramatic story like Lisa punched me, or it was a hockey hit that I laid on somebody and I lost a tooth in exchange. But when I was young and my permanent teeth were coming in, one of them grew down in the wrong place. So they had to pull it over and that left a gap there. And so they put a bridge in when I was in my low 20s. They put a bridge in. Kids, you don't know what a bridge is when it comes to dental work, but it connects to the two teeth on either side. It's basically a false tooth that connects to your two teeth on either side. And they're only supposed to last for 10 or 15 years, and then sometimes you start to have problems with them falling out. Well, I was sleeping Friday night, gone to sleep around 11:30 or so, and at 1:30 I was startled awake. And what startled me awake was the realization that my bridge had come out. But by God's grace, it was in my mouth. I didn't swallow it. I didn't choke on it. I didn't lose it, but that was an interesting way to be awakened at 1:30 in the morning. So if you've noticed that there's a gap where there shouldn't be a gap in my mouth, that was good observation. Now let me ask you a question. Was that of God's grace too? It was. Should I have responded in gratitude? I should have. Was gratitude my first thought? Oh, no. I've got to speak for this for Saturday morning, and then I've got to preach in church, and the dentist's office isn't going to be open on a Saturday. This is going to be really humbling. I can honestly say that my first thoughts were not thoughts of gratitude. Teeth lost are from God, and teeth found are from God. Everything we are and have is from God. Let's argue from the lesser to the greater. If teeth that are found are a gift from God, how much more when a family member who's walking away from God comes back to Him? How much more when we get a promotion at work that we didn't expect and that was undeserved? How much more when God gives us friends that enjoy being around us and help us and love us? How much more, kids, when you're put in a home where your parents are stable and they love God and they bring you to church? How much more when you have relatively good health? And we could just go down the list. Yesterday, when I was talking with Isabel, she told me something along the lines of this. She's starting to process more of what transpired, though she doesn't remember the accident. But as her mental function increases, she's able to process a little bit more. And she said something like this to me yesterday, and I'm paraphrasing, but she said, God could have let me die, but He must have a mission for me. I said, that's right. If He lets you live, He's got a purpose for you to continue to live on this planet. Even Isabel, with her limited mental function right now, though she didn't use the word, she understands the grace of God. That even an accident where your body is just demolished is a result of God's goodness. It's a fallen world. God is not responsible for sin and hurt, but He takes it and He turns it for good in our lives. Every part of our lives are dependent. Every part of our lives is dependent on God's wise plan for us. So can I ask you a question of application? Are you humbly grateful? Are you humbly grateful? Say, how would I know? Well, if you're a bragger, you're not. If you're a complainer, you're not. But if you say, Lord, I know that I'm not as grateful as I ought to be, but I want to be more grateful, Lord, here's the challenge. Be humbly grateful as you recall God's grace in your life. Be humbly grateful as you recall God's grace in your life, and that'll keep you from becoming inflated with pride.